Welcome. Let's continue in chapter 6 in Essays on the Gita, Man and the Battle of Life. And we noted it saw publication on the 15th of January in 1917. We got almost halfway through it, and Sri Aurobindo has guided us to recognize that war is an inevitable part of the current human condition. So what can we do to use the nature of battle, of conflict in life, to advance our personal growth, to grow more soulwards? And what can we do to greaten our societies? How can we use these conflicts to learn deep lessons if we must engage in them? And if we have to engage in them, must we annihilate all of civilization? To borrow a phrase from his own Savitri, where the queen mother of Savitri protests the fate for her child, an idiot hour destroys what centuries made. Huh. So we must be cognizant of our own motivations and how we act in our little spheres of life and how we connect to larger congruences and how we behave in the world indeed is our partner, and hopefully not simply at our mercy. But national defense, as he notes in that last phrase, carried to an insane extreme, makes its best attempt to become a national suicide. We throw everyone into the cauldron, and none escape. So he distinguishes what is the modern practice with war from what India's aim was and its high vision. So we'll pick it up here and go through to the rest of the chapter. Indian civilization, on the contrary, made it its chief aim to minimize the incidence and disaster of war. For this purpose, it limited the military obligation to the small class who, by their birth, nature, and traditions, were marked out for this function and found in it their natural means of self-development through the flowering of the soul in the qualities of courage, disciplined force, strong helpfulness, and chivalrous nobility, for which the warrior's life, pursued under the stress of a high ideal, gives a field of opportunities. The rest of the community was in every way guarded from slaughter and outrage. Their life and occupations were as little interfered with as possible, and the combative and destructive tendencies of human nature were given a restricted field, confined in a sort of lists, so as to do the minimum amount of harm to the general life of the race, while at the same time, by being subjected to high ethical ideals and every possible rule of humanity and chivalry, the function of war was obliged to help in ennobling and elevating instead of brutalizing those who performed it. This was generally true in great stretches of Indian history. And ironically, it is Ashoka, ironically named Ashoka, he who is without sorrow, who killed so many in what in these days we call Orissa, in the early years prior to the Common Era. It must be remembered that it is war of this kind and under these conditions that the Gita had in view. War considered as an inevitable part of human life, but so restricted and regulated as to serve, like other activities, the ethical and spiritual development, which was then regarded as the whole real object of life. War, destructive within certain carefully fixed limits of the bodily life of individual men, but constructive of their inner life and of the ethical elevation of the race. If you became a Kshatriya, you were expected to truly ennoble yourself, to behave according to the Dharma, to do no wrong, to protect, to serve. That was its distinguishing characteristic. And of course, Ashoka made an empire for himself that stretched through nearly the whole of India. So it seems that when you have no borders to your aggrandizement, you can commit the most heinous sins. Most of the wars that occurred in India, this was well known by the British, were within principalities, close neighbors, etc. They would dispute territory and old grievances might come up. But on the whole, there was not this idea that I will grab it all. That is much later when we look at the Mauryan Empire, Chandragupta. We see, of course, the Mughals, that this idea of gaining control of the whole of South Asia was something that was politically, economically desirable. That war in the past has, when subjected to an ideal, helped in this elevation, as in the development of knighthood and chivalry. The Indian ideal of the Kshatriya, the Japanese ideal of the samurai, can only be denied by the fanatics of pacifism. When it has fulfilled its function, it may well disappear. For if it tries to survive its utility, it will appear as an unrelieved brutality of violence, stripped of its ideal and constructive aspects, and will be rejected by the progressive mind of humanity. But its past service to the race must be admitted in any reasonable view of our evolution. The physical fact of war, however, is only a special and outward manifestation of a general principle in life, and the Kshatriya is only the outward manifestation and type of a general characteristic necessary to the completeness of human perfection. So here he connects a general theme in life to its appearance in human life, and thus it is inevitably part of it until we grow a greater life. War typifies and embodies physically the aspect of battle and struggle which belongs to all life, both to our inner and our outer living, in a world whose method is a meeting and wrestling of forces which progress by mutual destruction towards a continually changing adjustment expressive of a progressive harmonizing and hopeful of a perfect harmony based upon some yet ungrasped potentiality of oneness. The battle and the struggle back to Heraclitus, but aiming at something where it is no longer necessary, because all the elements can work together and arrange concord instead of discord. The Kshatriya is the type and embodiment of the fighter in man who accepts this principle in life and faces it as a warrior striving towards mastery, not shrinking from the destruction of bodies and forms, but through it all aiming at the realization of some principle of right, justice, law, which shall be the basis of the harmony towards which the struggle tends. The Gita accepts this aspect of the world energy and the physical fact of war which embodies it, and it addresses itself to the man of action, the striver and fighter, the kshatriya, war, which is the extreme contradiction of the soul's high aspiration to peace within and harmlessness without, the striver and fighter, whose necessary turmoil of struggle and action seems to be the very contradiction of the soul's high ideal of calm mastery and self-possession, and it seeks for an issue from the contradiction, a point at which its terms meet, and a poise which shall be the first essential basis of harmony and transcendence. He translates harmlessness from the term ahimsa, absence of hurt. Man meets the battle of life in the manner most consonant with the essential quality most dominant in his nature. There are, according to the Sankhya philosophy accepted in this respect by the Gita, three essential qualities or modes of the world energy, and therefore also of human nature. Sattva, the mode of poise, knowledge, and satisfaction. Rajas, the mode of passion, action, and struggling emotion. Tamas, the mode of ignorance and inertia. Now surely we'll come to a chapter and a point in the Gita where we will stop and discuss at some length the nature of the Sankhyan philosophy and the appearance of its terminology throughout the Gita, and in fact dominating the rest of Indian philosophy and spirituality. But aren't you glad that isn't this evening? Dominated by tamas, man does not so much meet the rush and shock of the world energy swirling about him and converging upon him as he succumbs to them, is overborne by them, afflicted, subjected, or at the most, helped by the other qualities. The tamasic man seeks only somehow to survive, to subsist so long as he may, to shelter himself in the fortress of an established routine of thought and action, in which he feels himself to a certain extent protected from the battle, able to reject the demand which his higher nature makes upon him, excused from accepting the necessity of farther struggle and the ideal of an increasing effort and mastery. Note here, of course, that all the three gunas are the constructive elements of any movement of nature, and all three gunas are present in every touch of nature. There is nothing absent any one of them. There is not a complete dominance of sattva, rajas, and tamas anywhere. All three are always present in varying qualities. So if you took tamas and you added a little something to it, you'd get the result of this last part of the sentence we just read. He'll continue with that. So that was dominated by tamas. Dominated by rajas, man flings himself into the battle and attempts to use the struggle of forces for his own egoistic benefit, to slay, conquer, dominate, enjoy. Or helped by a certain measure of the sattvic quality, the rajasic man makes the struggle itself a means of increasing inner mastery, joy, power, possession. the battle of life becomes his delight and passion, partly for its own sake, for the pleasure of activity and the sense of power, partly as a means of his increase and natural self-development. Dominated by sattva, man seeks in the midst of the strife for a principle of law, right, poise, harmony, peace, satisfaction. The purely sattvic man tends to seek this within, whether for himself alone or with an impulse to communicate it, when one, to other human minds, but usually by a sort of inner detachment from, or else an outer rejection of, the strife and turmoil of the active world energy. But if the sattvic mind accepts partly the rajasic impulse, it seeks rather to impose this poise and harmony upon the struggle and apparent chaos, to vindicate a victory for peace, love, and harmony over the principle of war, discord, and struggle. All the attitudes adopted by the human mind towards the problem of life either derive from the domination of one or other of these qualities, or else from an attempt at balance and harmony between them. Just a note on the Sanskrit here. The gunas are all pronounced with short vowels, so it's sattva, tamas, rajas. But when they become adjectives, that first vowel is elongated, so then it's sattvic, rajasic, tamasic. So if you hear me going back and forth, that's why. I'm just more or less putting it in front of you the way it would be spoken. Tamasika, etc. That may be me. So, but there comes also a stage in which the mind recoils from the whole problem and, dissatisfied with the solutions given by the threefold mode of nature, trigunya, seeks for some higher solution outside of it or else above it. And this is second chapter, the 45th shloka. It looks for an escape either into something which is outside and void of all qualities and therefore of all activity, or in something which is superior to the three qualities and master of them, and therefore at once capable of action and unaffected, undominated by its own action in the nirguna or the trigunatita. That's chapter 13, shloka 14. It aspires to an absolute peace and unconditioned existence, or to a dominant calm and superior existence. The natural movement of the former attitude is towards the renunciation of the world, sannyasa. Of the latter, towards superiority to the claims of the lower nature and its whirl of actions and reactions, and its principle is equality and the inner renunciation of passion and desire. So some probably should mention this now, could mention it on the next page, but sannyasa, from sannyas, to throw down together, to get rid of it, to despoil yourself of it. So you're getting rid of something. And that leads, of course, to the renunciation of the world, because what are you throwing down? The world, its complexities, the confusions of every moment that beset one? No. For me, the spirit, pure and simple, gone. World, goodbye. And the other, a superiority to the claims of the lower nature, an inner renunciation of passion and desire based on equality. And equality is samatva, and that's chapter 2, shloka 48, we usually say samatha. Samatva is how it appears in the Gita. And what it means is the inner renunciation. Something may happen, the outer person may like or dislike it, but the inner person is untouched, does not claim the fruit of the work done. And because of that, is free. Huh. The whole secret to action then. Back to this, the distinction between sannyasa and tyaga, which is what that inner renunciation is. The former is the first impulse of Arjuna, recoiling from the calamitous culmination of all his heroic activity in the great cataclysm of battle and massacre, Kurukshetra. Losing his whole past principle of action, inaction, and the rejection of life and its claims seemed to him the only issue. So far as he can see, there's only one way out, to throw down the bow, to leave the field, and quit life. But it is to an inner superiority, and not to the physical renunciation of life and action, that he is called by the voice of the divine teacher. Rather immediately and starkly, pick up the bow. Arjuna is the kshatriya, the rajasic man who governs his rajasic action by a high sattvic ideal. So light applied to force. He advances to this gigantic struggle, to this Kurukshetra, with the full acceptance of the joy of battle as to a holiday of fight, but with a proud confidence in the righteousness of his cause. He advances in his rapid chariot, tearing the hearts of his enemies with the victorious clamor of his war conch, for he wishes to look upon all these kings of men who have come here to champion against him the cause of unrighteousness and establishes a rule of life, the disregard of law, justice, and truth, which they would replace by the rule of a selfish and arrogant egoism. A recurring theme in human life. So this is chapter 1, almost all of this, ranging from 1:14-15 to 1:22-23. When this confidence is shattered within him, when he is smitten down from his customary attitude and mental basis of life, that's 1:27 and 1:45. It is by the uprush of the tamasic quality into the rajasic man, inducing a recoil of astonishment, grief, horror, dismay, dejection, bewilderment of the mind, and the war of reason against itself, a collapse towards the principle of ignorance and inertia. So instead of reacting from light, he's allowed an uprush of darkness from below to overwhelm him. This is not the posture for a kshatriya, the most noble person in the field, the greatest warrior on the field, untouchable, guaranteed victory. As a result, he turns towards renunciation. So it is tamas that pulls him towards renunciation and the cancellation of life and its struggle. This is a tamasic reaction. This is not a step above towards light. This is a step towards darkness. Better the life of the mendicant living upon alms than this dharma of the kshatriya. 2.5. this battle and action culminating in undiscriminating massacre, this principle of mastery and glory and power, which can only be won by destruction and bloodshed, this conquest of blood-stained enjoyments, this vindication of justice and right by a means which contradicts all righteousness, and this affirmation of the social law by a war which destroys in its process and result all that constitutes society. Sannyasa is the renunciation of life and action and of the threefold modes of nature. But it has to be approached through one or other of the three qualities. The impulse may be tamasic, a feeling of impotence, fear, aversion, disgust, horror of the world and life. Or it may be the rajasic quality tending towards tamas, an impulse of weariness of the struggle, grief, disappointment, refusal to accept any longer this vain turmoil of activity with its pains and its eternal discontent. Or the impulse may be that of rajas tending towards sattva, the impulse to arrive at something superior to anything life can give, to conquer a higher state, to trample down life itself under the feet of an inner strength which seeks to break all bonds and transcend all limits. Or it may be sattvic, an intellectual perception of the vanity of life and the absence of any real goal or justification for this ever-cycling world existence, or else a spiritual perception of the timeless, the infinite, the silent, the nameless and formless peace beyond. The recoil of Arjuna is the tamasic recoil from action of the sattva rajasic man. The teacher may confirm it in its direction, using it as a dark entry to the purity and peace of the ascetic life, or he may purify it at once and raise it towards the rare altitudes of the sattvic tendency of renunciation. In fact, he does neither. He discourages the tamasic recoil and the tendency to renunciation, and enjoins the continuance of action and even of the same fierce and terrible action. But he points the disciple towards another and inner renunciation, which is the real issue from his crisis and the way towards the soul's superiority to the world nature and yet its calm and self-possessed action in the world. Not a physical asceticism, but an inner ascesis is the teaching of the Gita. Not sannyasa, but tyaga. And of course, adepts as you are in English, you know that when he uses the term issue, he means, you know, this path, this is the way. It's not a topic. He means the path that leads out. It's the issue, hence. So that's our chapter. Next, the creed of the Aryan fighter. Arjuna has to remember who he is. He has to begin from where he is, and we'll see him climb step by step towards the spiritual harmony that we can attain even, as he says, in the fiercest struggle of life, even in war. On the subject of battle, we can find some lines in Savitri which complement what he's written here. So let's look in Book 6 at the Book of Fate, Canto 2, The Way of Fate and the Problem of Pain. We'll start on page 446. The seed of Godhead sleeps in mortal hearts. The flower of Godhead grows on the world tree. All shall discover God in self and things. But when God's messenger comes to help the world and lead the soul of earth to higher things, he too must carry the yoke he came to unloose. He too must bear the pang that he would heal. Exempt and unafflicted by earth's fate, how shall he cure the ills he never felt? He covers the world's agony with his calm. But though to the outward eye no sign appears, and peace is given to our torn human hearts, the struggle is there and paid the unseen price. The fire, the strife, the wrestle are within. He carries the suffering world in his own breast. It sends way on his thoughts, its grief is his. Earth's ancient load lies heavy on his soul. Night and its powers beleaguer his tardy steps. The Titan adversary's clutch he bears. His march is a battle and a pilgrimage. Life's evil smites. He is stricken with the world's pain. A million wounds gape in his secret heart. He journeys sleepless through an unending night. Antagonist forces crowd across his path. A siege, a combat is his inner life. Even worse may be the cost, direr the pain. His large identity and all-harboring love shall bring the cosmic anguish into his depths. The sorrow of all living things shall come and knock at his doors and live within his house. A dreadful cord of sympathy can tie all suffering into his single grief and make all agony in all the worlds his own. He meets an ancient adversary force. He is lashed with the whips that tear the world's worn heart. The weeping of the centuries visits his eyes. He wears the blood-glued, fiery centaur shirt. The poison of the world has stained his throat. In the marketplace of matter's capital, amidst the chafferings of the affair called life, he is tied to the stake of a perennial fire. He burns on an unseen original verge, that matter may be turned to spirit stuff. He is the victim in his own sacrifice. The immortal bound to earth's mortality, appearing and perishing on the roads of time, creates God's moment by eternity's beats. He dies that the world may be newborn and live. Even if he escapes the fiercest fires, even if the world breaks not in a drowning sea, only by hard sacrifice is high heaven earned. He must face the fight, the pang, who would conquer hell. A dark, concealed hostility is lodged in the human depths, in the hidden heart of time, that claims the right to change and mar God's work. A secret enmity ambushes the world's march. It leaves a mark on thought and speech and act. It stamps stain and defect on all things done, till it is slain. Peace is forbidden on earth. There is no visible foe, but the unseen is round us. Forces intangible besiege. Touches from alien realms, thoughts not our own, overtake us and compel the erring heart. Our lives are caught in an ambiguous net. An adversary force was born of old. Invader of the life of mortal man, it hides from him the straight immortal path. A power came in to veil the eternal light, a power opposed to the eternal will, diverts the messages of the infallible word, contorts the contours of the cosmic plan. A whisper lures to evil the human heart. It seals up wisdom's eyes, the soul's regard. It is the origin of our suffering here. It binds earth to calamity and pain. This all must conquer who would bring down God's peace. This hidden foe, lodged in the human breast, man must overcome or miss his higher fate. This is the inner war without escape. Namaste. Jai Ma, I hope you're all well.